James, can you tell me, please, what inspired you to start Access Space in the first place? When did the seed first come into existence?
I think there were a whole combination of things that made Access Space seem like a very obvious idea. On the one hand, I'd been working as an artist in Sheffield. Now, for young artist, you can really read unemployed person with poor attitude. And I wanted to get involved with technology. I thought the possibilities for maybe communicating all the things that I had to do with, pictures and sculptures and all sorts of interesting events and ideas that I had, maybe I could communicate those electronically. But at the same time, I was completely skint. I didn't have any cash. And it seemed as if job number one was raise £1,000 and pay it to the richest man in the world for the right to work. And I thought, well, I don't even want to start off down that line.
Can you explain what you mean?
Well, you know,
raise £1,000 for what? For
a legitimate
copy of Windows, or what do you mean?
Absolutely. I mean, what was happening at the time was I was kind of coming across people who pretentiously called themselves digital artists. And there was a whole, this was the early 90s, and there was a whole dialogue going on with people saying, hey, the internet, it's really anarchic, it's really creative, it's got huge democratizing potential. And hey, look at my cool laptop, it cost £1,000, and all these fantastic applications programs, that's actually £6,000 worth of software. I'm not sure whether they actually paid £6,000 for that software, but the point was still the same, which is that somehow they were using the idea of this being a democratizing medium. At the same time, they were saying, oh yeah, there's a very expensive entrance fee you have to pay just to get involved. Hey, it's really democratizing. Look at us, we're part of an elite.
Well, yes, even if you're using pirate software, you still have to be in the know to get the pirate software.
And at the same time, you've also got a deeply disempowering thing happening to you, which is that you're going along with it, you're agreeing with, colluding with the proposition that to be creative with technology isn't really allowed. And you feel that by pirating software, you're going along with that. You're feeling that's okay. Now, I don't think that's okay. Mm. I think it's really important that an individual, unfunded, independent person who's got something to say should be able to say it online without having special permission, without paying a very large amount of money for software license fees and so on.
There is also the aspect of all the computers that are being dumped that are still quite usable.
Well,
you have foresight back in the early 90s that there would be all these untapped hardware resources.
Well, the story was much less clever than the result, if you like. I was a junk sculptor. I was making all sorts of sculptures and paintings with stuff that I pulled out of the trash. And I realized that I'd like to get involved with information technology. I didn't have any money. And then I started finding computers in the trash. Now, it kind of became very obvious that this was an interesting thing to do. I was amazed to find that most of the computers that I was pulling out of skips and dumpsters were still active, you know, even to the point where they'd power up and turn on. But then to realize that I could actually use them for some kind of usable computing was a real shock. You know, I had thought that maybe I could just use these things to kind of build some kind of crazy robot or something like this. But, you know, very, very quickly in the mid-90s, we started getting useful computers. And by useful computer at the time, I meant maybe a 486 with a 3.5-inch floppy disk drive rather than a than an old-style 5-inch, 5.25-inch floppy disk drive. So a 3.5-inch floppy disk, a hard disk that you could store stuff on, and maybe even a colour screen. Now, at the time, I thought that would be something that, you know, that's the kind of computer power that in the 1960s, you know, a government would be envious of. You know, and suddenly people are throwing it in the skip. But at the time, one of the kind of key watchwords of the Organization Redundant Technology Initiative, which was the kind of precursor of Access Space, I said to people, look, this is a great idea this year, but it'll be an even better idea next year. And now in 2006, I have to say, this is even truer now than it's been ever before. This year, we're recovering 600 to 800 megahertz Pentium 3s. We're starting to get 1.2 gigahertz machines at the top end. Occasionally, we'll get a board which is of about that speed. Typically, we're able to bank them up with 256 or even 512 megs of RAM. Next year, we're going to get even better stuff.
And the creative projects that you're doing now, they don't require that extra hardware, and yet you've got the systems in place, you've got the skills in place that can use the less demanding software. And so when you get this more powerful hardware, you'll be able to just multiply what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the thing. I guess part of the point of the proposition is to say, if you're using a computer in a creative way, are you absolutely sure that the thing that's stopping you being creative is the technology? Or is it actually your skills? I mean, at home, for example, I only have machines that are about 400 megahertz. I think I've got a file server which is about 250 megahertz. Now, I keep meaning to upgrade it, but I haven't got around to it. And also, I keep finding that the problem is I don't know enough. You know, I keep finding new skills, new fantastic little bash scripts and, you know, bits of coding and so on that mean that I can get more out of any one given piece of technology. You know, so I'm the problem. I just don't know enough.
So you can actually go backwards with the hardware as you go forwards with this project. And so there's no excuse now for artists to say, well, I'm a poor, struggling artist, I don't have the technology available, because Access Space offers its space to artists and creative people for free.
That's entirely true, but we can only help artists in Sheffield. In fact, what we're doing is, if you like, on a larger scale, is we're demonstrating to everyone across the world that you can be creative with technology that costs nothing. And all you need to do to actually unlock that is to start learning things. Now, there is a problem. Look, I always say, if you get involved with technology, you have to pay. There's no way that you can not pay if you get involved with information technology. What we've illustrated is you don't have to pay with money. You can pay with time and effort in learning. And, you know, if you're the sort of artist who goes, oh, no, I'm an artist, I can't possibly get involved in, I believe they're sort of lower middle class technical things. I think those are people like plumbers. But anyway, I'm far too highfalutin for that sort of thing. I just wanted, I want my gnomes to make it work. That's no problem. Just pay them. Just pay out real cash money for technicians who you don't have to socialise with, guys, right? But I'm telling you, if you're an artist, you don't have the money, so get real and start realising that the only way you're really going to get to grips with this medium is by learning about it.
And there's room for artists' access space to help with actual hard yakka, as we say in Australia, moving equipment, picking up the tons of machines that are coming your way, more than you can handle, you told me.
That's absolutely true. You know, we're recovering many hundreds of computers per year. I reckon at the moment we're probably turning over about 500 computers a year, but that's with very little publicity associated with our recycling campaign. We could quite easily double, triple, or, you know...
Turning over, do you mean computers that you are handing on to end users, or computers that are coming through through your system?
I mean computers that are coming through the system and we're either reusing them or we're recycling them. Hopefully we're handing, you know, as high a proportion on as we possibly can.
And by recycling, you mean the raw materials?
Absolutely. I mean, everyone likes the name, you know, everyone likes recycling. Recycling is really green. It's really good, isn't it? But in fact, recycling is the moment at which we've failed. Because what's more valuable, a global communications centre or a couple of pounds worth of scrap metal? Now, in the end, our proposition is that it's a kind of more valuable thing in the end to have some kind of global communications centre than it is to have, you know, a small amount of extra copper in the world. Now, you know, the thing that's stopping people from actually reusing as many computers as we can recover is skills. All the time, people are saying, oh, yeah, I don't know how to do it. I don't know. Oh, if I had one of those new PowerMac G14s, I could be really creative. And if you like, people are buying into sometimes the kind of marketing situation that you get where, you know, IT companies are saying, oh, you know, just pay us. You know, all these things are so easy to use. You won't need to learn a thing. And it has to be said, that's false.
Yes, one is made to feel inadequate unless they buy into the program. So there's also the concept of recycling, reusing software, as in just people's experiences and knowledge, not just a machine. There's value and power to be gained from withholding these used machines so that people will buy new machines and just throwing them in the skip and reusing the copper, the gold, what have you. For some people, hanging on to those skills also keeps the power in their hands. How can you convince the corporations to stop peddling this idea that you have to have the latest and greatest, even though people haven't even learned to 20% of the functions on their mobile phone, and not just the corporations? How do you get the people with the skills to pass on their information and their knowledge? In your experience, how have you found that?
I think that on an individual level, real people in a one-to-one situation, you know, in a face-to-face situation, are incredibly enthusiastic to pass on their skills. You know, there's nothing people like more than to be asked for advice and, you know, asked to consult with their expertise. You know, one of the things that we've tried to really encourage at Access Space is a real resistance to the, ooh, wow, that's just amazing kind of culture. You know, occasionally people may come into Access Space and we'll say to them, wow, that's a really cool kind of PHP script, or that's an amazing piece of video you've got there. How did you do it? And very occasionally people will say, ah, it's a secret. And we say, you know, we're not impressed. Don't be such a jerk. It's like, if you're saying that, almost certainly the thing that you've done is very, very simple. If it was complicated...
I would agree that's not experience. You know. Even with DJing, people get intimidated if they don't know so much and you want to show... Now, you talk about reusing is much better for the environment than recycling.
Absolutely.
The usual catchphrase for environmentalists is, in order of preference, reduce, reuse, recycle. So what would you say to the people that claim we would be better off reducing the use of technology before we even consider reusing it?
Well, what I'd say is every time you reuse a computer, then you're not buying a new one. Now, the irony of this whole situation is that on the one hand, you've got, if you like, government and strategic agencies all over the place saying, we really would like people to get more involved with technology. And I have to say, I agree with that. In fact, I think the potential for individual empowerment of communicating on the internet is absolutely massive. You know, if people haven't gathered this yet, you don't need a license. You don't need permission. You don't need a budget. And you can communicate with tens of thousands of people all over the world. This has never happened in human history before. Not ever. And if it doesn't change something, I feel we're not trying hard enough.
And you know? Are you trying to direct the content of that communication?
Well, I think the most important thing is that people actually get stuck into what they're interested in. You know, what can, you know, they're the people who can tell them what can empower themselves. You know, and in the end, I think that we should be driven. You know, Access Spaces, you know, tries to provide an opportunity for people to find out what floats their boat, what they're interested in, and they should go with that. They, you know, if you like, people coming into Access Space, they really do need to provide the enthusiasm. You know, and so rather than us telling them what to do, you know, we'd really like them to tell us what they're going to do. You know, I guess that though there are several kind of issues that have come up that we've kind of skirted around. One is how artists and creative people might contribute in Access Space. Now, it's very easy to say, oh, well, I don't know anything about computers, I don't have any technical skills. So I like the idea of information sharing, but I don't have anything to bring to the table. Wrong, wrong, wrong. What we find is that with lots of people who maybe are from kind of creative backgrounds, artistic or musical backgrounds, one of the key things that they have that other people don't have is content. They've got something to say. Frequently, we'll get people coming in the door of Access Space and saying, oh, I've got, you know, I've got all these technical skills. I'm not really quite sure why I'm here. We'll talk to them and ask them what they've done, and they'll say, oh, well, at home I've made this whole network out of computers that I've recycled from my friends and neighbours. I've kind of wired up all the rooms in my house. We had one guy come in and say, I've now got a keyboard in every room in my house so that I can wirelessly message myself from any room. You're looking a bit mystified there, and we were too. You know, it's like, yeah, great. And what's the point? And so there are people who sometimes have got prodigious ability to implement technological things. The catch is they haven't got any content. Yes. They've actually not got any motivation. At the same time, we'll have artists or musicians coming into the space and saying, hey, I've got this really great idea for a website, and it's like you click it and it would change and ripple, and then it would show pictures and it'd play images, it'd play videos, and we say, it's really great, we're really impressed, we really like all your ideas, how are you going to do it? And they'll say, and they don't have an answer.
Do you feel that by Access Space being a physical space actually gives more opportunities for people to network and complement each other than they would, say, with MySpace or something like this?
That's absolutely the point. The point is to get people together who've got different skill sets, different backgrounds, different ideas, and try and get them working together. Because, of course, you know, if you like, the Access Space, we hope, we aim that it's a highly sustainable model. So we're working with software that doesn't cost anything, and we're working with hardware that's recycled from the local area. Okay? But crucially, we're also working with people from the local area. And essentially our proposition is you already have all the things you need. In the local area, you have the skills, you have the creativity, you have the opportunity. You just probably didn't realize it before. And so if with Access Space all we're doing is we're actually mobilizing the resources that are already present, that's kind of like the minimum intervention and the maximum amount of sustainability. Wow, that's just a lot of jargon.
Just for the listeners, James, I'd like to explain the layout of Access Space. It's basically one large room with terminals or screens, terminal sounds, yeah. Some screens around one horseshoe shape on one side of the room, and chairs and round table in the middle, and you have free coffee and tea with a bucket for donations, and,
yeah,
and it's communal feel, and people take breaks, they sit down, they discuss. And is that your model, that you just informally let it sort itself out, let people meet each other, or do you formally match people up?
We try to find out through, you know, the advanced, you know, communication mechanism of conversation, what people are interested in, you know, maybe what skills they've got, what problems they've got, what, you know, what sort of ideas they're trying to address, and we try and introduce people to other people.
Do they ring you up and make a booking? Do they fill out forms?
Some people like to ring us up and say, oh, can I come down on such and such a day? Some people just walk in the door. Some people ring us up and they say, can I turn up on such and such a day? They turn up at a different time. You know, that's very common.
And there's no reception desk,
you know,
there.
Essentially, what we try to do is we try to make sure that whenever anyone comes in the door, yes, at Access Space, someone will talk to them within 10 seconds. Okay, so we're trying all the time to just keep everyone aware. And someone, whether it's a volunteer, whether it's a member of our very small team, or whether it's just another participant in Access Space, will say, hi, welcome to Access Space. What, you know, who are you? What are you doing? Tell them their name. You know, try and get something going. Try and make someone feel comfortable. Now, I've visited quite a lot of nominally open access technological projects, hack labs, cyber cafes and so on across Europe and further afield as well. And sometimes you'll get a situation where everyone organizing it will say, hey, this is open access, anyone can get involved. But in fact, the real life situation is that if you walk in the door, you see the backs of 10 scary looking computer guys, and you're really not quite sure whether you're meant to be there or not. You're obviously not quite in the club. And so we deliberately try to make sure that a friendly person will come up and have a chat with you straight away. Otherwise, you can get in a situation of feeling very uncomfortable. You're not quite sure whether you're meant to be there. And I think that's a really, it sounds like a small and trivial thing, but actually it's a really big thing.
Yes. So do you have problems finding volunteers to help you like that?
In general, we've got a long history of people volunteering Access Space in all sorts of roles. And we've gone through formal processes of volunteering. We've had very free and easy phases in which, you know, people have just kind of filled in the way that they think is appropriate. I think at the moment we're in a phase where what we're trying to do is make sure that volunteers get as much support as they possibly can. You know, if someone's volunteering Access Space, we do want to make sure that they get value out of the process. You know, whether that be that they've, you know, created something, learned something, got a qualification maybe, you know. And so, you know, if you like, we try to keep track of volunteers, and I think the kind of jargon is manage them in some sort of job-like way. But, you know, it's kind of everyone knows where they are a lot more if people have got some kind of description of what it is they're trying to achieve, and you know, then some support to help them to achieve that. And also someone to go to and, you know, gives a shout if they feel like they're kind of left out in the cold or they haven't got the skills that they need. Or
and how many people do you have employed there currently? And how many and how long has it taken you to get that many? How many do you have at the beginning?
Initially, right at the start of Access Space, we only had 2 part-time funded roles. Okay, this was in 2000. And to give you an idea of the sort of level of funding that we had, we'd I think, accessed something like £65,000 of funding to run the project for 2 years. Now, at the time, I thought, wow, that's a huge amount of money. We're going to be able to do that easy, no problem. But then to realise that actually what that meant was £32,000 to run Access Space open 5 days a week for a year. And the rent on the space and the taxes that we'd have to pay, the rates and the electricity bill and so on, that would soak up maybe about £12,000 or £15,000, so possibly half that money. We then realised we had to run Access Space open 5 days a week for £15,000.
And you had to pick up the machines as well yourselves.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. So there's a huge amount of activity. Very, very quickly we realised that was an inadequate amount of money. So fortunately, we managed to raise some more money to actually add to that. And almost immediately we were able to about double that amount of money. And that enabled us to have 2 roles. Now, quite quickly, by 2001, we had a team of 4 part-time people. Now we've got to the stage where we've got 6 people working part-time, which equates to, in full-time terms, if everyone was working full-time, we'd have 3.5 people working for us.
Well,
I don't know what the half is. Is it the top half or the bottom half? I don't know, you know, that half.
You yourself seem to be full-time involved.
Well, I kind of, yeah, I don't really have much of a life. I think, you know, on my days off, I kind of tend to go down to Access Space and, well, maybe tidy up some spare work and, you know, do some other things as well, you know, to kind of keep things running. But, you know.
Have you ever had anybody employed full-time?
No, we've never had a full-time employee. The most that people have done is 4 days a week.
Is that deliberate?
Well, I mean, in my case, I'm still meant to be doing all sorts of creative digital arts things. And so in my sort of extra day a week or what have you, I try to pursue those things. I've got a studio space and kind of got a vast number of computers in that, and I'm sort of making installations and artworks and so on. I think I'd find it quite difficult if I didn't kind of have the opportunity to have, you know, a small amount of time at least every week to put into doing that. Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where we don't want to kind of make the organisation rely too much on a very small number of people. We'd rather kind of spread it wider and try and make as kind of robust a team as possible. You know, lots of people have changes in their lives. Maybe they have a family, they get a new job, they, you know, go from here to there. But if we're employing someone for, say, 2 days a week, then frequently they can have quite significant changes in their life and keep on working for us and keep on being enthusiastic.
So now, in the middle of 2006, or towards the end of 2006, how many of the original crew do you still have there?
Just me.
And where did the others?
Right. We've had, out of the original crew, one person's working in IT now. They've got a really kind of quite well paid IT job, I think. The swine. We've also got one of the original team is now self-employed as a funding consultant. And in fact, she does work for us. We actually employ her to develop our funding strategy and things like that. But rather than employ her as a member of the team, now she's kind of an outside consultant who comes in and, you know, helps us out. This is actually, you know, the word consultant can have a very negative connotations about it. But realistically, what it means is that she can put aside a couple of weeks to, you know, work in a really concentrated way on our kind of planning and funding applications, seeing where we're up to. And then she can go away again, you know, which is a really good thing.
Okay, speaking of arts and creative processes, how do you avoid school kids coming in and playing Doom all day on their computers there? I mean,
we haven't successfully managed to install Doom, I think. We try and encourage a kind of a creative atmosphere.
Doom, by the way, is a shoot 'em up role-playing game.
I was going to say, I'm not sure how much role playing there is involved in it, and how much it's just shooting, actually. The computers that we're using aren't great for games, right? If you're a game head, you'll be dissatisfied by the fact that you might be sitting in front of an 800 megahertz base unit, especially one that doesn't run Windows and hasn't got all the games pre-installed ready for you to just click go. You know, so. We do get some young people coming in playing games, but what we found is that actually some games are a really good learning tool. Our kind of impulse is, we've got kind of two levels of impulse. You know, on the one hand, we'd like to discourage people using the net just purely as consumers. What we're trying to do all the time, and what we explain to people when they come in, is that we really want people to stop just becoming an IT consumer and start being a net producer. So we want to, you know, that's what we're interested in. And through kind of subtle social pressure, we're constantly, you know, asking people how they're getting on with their project, what their project actually is. You know, have they learned about HTML? Have they learned about graphics processing? Are they able to...
Do you find that they are interested in those things? Does it take much pushing?
People are always... You know, you can play around for only so long, and then you suddenly show people how to do, like, a 3D model or something like that. And different things, you know, interest different people, you know.
What people are there in terms of age groups, in terms of gender?
Well, I mean, today... Today, the age group wise, the oldest person we had coming to use the space is John. He's 70. I think he's 71 years old now. He's a regular user. Comes in with his laptop. He logs in with that. He's also got his own user account. In fact, he got a laptop. He had the confidence to buy a laptop after he learned a whole load of things at Access Space.
So, is he using Linux?
Yes, he's using Linux. He's got Ubuntu Linux, I think, installed on that. He's a dab hand with dual boot as well.
Why do you think he bought a machine instead of getting one of the recent...
Well, I mean, at the time, he just... I think there's a whole load of sound processing stuff that he really wanted to do. He just wanted a really simple... solution for him, and he wanted quite a high specification laptop. It's actually been really good for him. I mean, the irony of it is, now he bought that, what, two and a half years ago. Now we're starting to get given machines that are of a similar specification to the one that he bought. But hey, he had his retirement money at the time, so you know, it was a, you know.
So he's not like a good teacher for the new laptops, for the old laptops coming in.
You know, quite.
Are there other people also older?
And we'll get people, from their 40s, 50s, 60s coming in. But, I mean, I'm just talking about today.
Are the older people, do you think they feel comfortable putting their head even in the space?
I hope so. And I think one of the things that's really important is that we do actually get talking to people right away. You know, I think that certainly if you've got kind of 10 cyber dudes, you know, who are most likely, you know, what I mean by that is guys who are usually white, a bit scruffy, and they're probably between 18 and 24 years old, right? That could be a pretty scary experience if you happen to be, say, a middle-aged woman. You know, in that you just don't feel confident.
Or even a tan, sporting...
Absolutely. You know, whatever it is, you know. And so We think it's really important to kind of try and break down barriers by talking to people as soon as possible.
Is it only within Access Space, or do you have a physical presence at festivals, at fairs?
We're trying to do more outreach work now. That's what we call it. You know, that's the sort of the jargon for it. But we've undertaken to do a huge amount of work with very, very little funding for what we, compared to what we do. And so, informally, we try to, get out to different places and make people aware of Access Space. But at the same time, we've got to be aware, if people are going out to these places and we're getting organized, we're shipping computers out there, we really like to pay people if we possibly can to do that. And it's something we'd like to do a lot more of. Fortunately, we've just got some money in for a 3-year project to do that sort of thing around Sheffield. And we think that could be quite interesting.
Have you ever had money from private institutions?
Some, but not so much commercial sponsorship, more trust foundations and so on. Now, I tell you what, you were still asking me about age ranges, and I only talked about John, who's 70-odd. Meanwhile, today we've had some teenagers come into the space. I think the youngest of them's 14 years old, right? And they've been doing all sorts of internet things. They tend to kind of work on a kind of pack basis. They like to teach each other. Lots of interesting things have happened through that. We've got at first the kids were just goofing around looking at websites. We're encouraging them to say, hey, look, you can take these images and you can download the images and then change them, mix them up for yourself, make new pictures and so on. We're quite interested in that. But then also we kind of pushed them in other ways, like, for example, Rekha, demographic Rekha's she must be in her 50s, I think, a woman, and not with an IT background at all. And she was saying to them, look, you guys, you're being too noisy in the space. You're really disrupting other people when they're trying to concentrate. And so really creatively, the younger guys found out about instant messaging clients and now able to communicate across Access Space without shouting across the space. So they can say rude things about Rekha behind her back and she doesn't even know. But no, it's kind of that's been a really interesting sort of creative
thing. So there have been a few women and
that's quite interesting. We've actually had a real push to get more women involved with the space. Now, what we found over the years is that if we just provide what you might call drop-in access, then usage is typically about 70% male, 70 to 80% male, something like that. So 3/4 of our usage is by guys when it comes to drop-in access. But when we run things like workshops, then we find that it's typically 50 to 60% female.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because guys are happy to hang out. I don't think guys are, and I'm being polite here, I don't think they're necessarily very structured about their time. If we have the proposition, hey, if you fiddle around with this computer, you can find some things out, then, guys are happy to hang out, have some tea and, hang out with a computer and not really understand it, come back tomorrow and do some more. Whereas I think that women's time is very much more structured frequently. It's like they're organizing the family, they've got their job organized, they're what have you. And so if they're coming in to learn something, they'd really like to learn something between 10 a.m. and 12, and they'd like to get some kind of agenda sorted out in that time.
So it's not just informal then. So you do have workshops.
Yeah. And in fact, we've deliberately targeted workshops towards women and towards people who we've perceived haven't been using the space as heavily. And for example, people from ethnic minorities who may have less confidence with IT or may not sort of feel as comfortable to walk into a space that, you know, with a whole bunch of people who they don't know from backgrounds they don't know about. And so, you know, we deliberately target workshops to kind of help these people participate.
The other night you had workshops showing people how to put together machines.
That's right, yeah. Those were targeted as some young people from the Manor, which is quite a deprived area of Sheffield. There are a lot of, you know, there's a high level of unemployment in that area, and lots of problems with skills. There are lots of families that are living on the Manor estate who've had unemployment problems for generation after generation. Now, these people want to work. They're really enthusiastic about the idea of someone giving them a job.
Yes.
But perhaps they've got low levels of skill, low levels of literacy, and low levels of engagement. And so it's very difficult. This is a legacy of Sheffield's industrial past.
Did their parents consent to their children spending time with something so abstract? Well, I guess not so abstract. You're actually teaching them how to physically put together machines.
Absolutely.
Resellable machines,
yeah.
Even.
Yeah, and also learning about how they can get machines from their friends or out of skips in their local area and start using their own.
You have
own
no
purposes.
Problem with competition.
Yeah.
If they were to start another access space.
We're positively encouraging people to start more access spaces. Now, look, we know we're not going to run out of computers. If we only got given a tenth of the number of computers that we're getting given now, we could still operate.
And how do you deal with the... You must get lots of components that don't work, they're unusable. What do you do? You're lumped with them.
We've got good destinations for individual components that we can, you know, recycle. Some of them get reused. I mean, for example, at the moment we've got a really good connection with a charity that is able to batch up, test these monitors and actually export them and get paid good money to do that, and those monitors will actually get remade into televisions. Now, some ultra green people may say to us, yeah, well, what happens to those televisions when they die? And you're absolutely right, we don't know. They may get disposed of in an inappropriate way. However, if we didn't do that exporting, if we didn't have that link, then what would happen to the televisions that are newly manufactured in the place of the ones that get reused?
Okay.
You know? So it's
which
like...
brings us back to what I asked before, which I'd like to come back to, the idea of reduce, reuse,
yeah.
Recycle, because you have in the past given me very good reasons why it is useful to actually reuse and not... I mean, while I have a lot of respect for the Luddite philosophy, it's given a bad name. You've talked about how we are immersed in technology and we need to engage in it to remain empowered.
I really believe that. I think that, you know, I'm able to communicate widely across the world and get a whole load of ideas across which I think are important thanks to the internet. Thanks, internet. And if I didn't participate in that, I wouldn't be doing that. You know, and I think that a lot of people, I've seen a lot of people who've come into access space and learned skills, realized that there is no barrier to them communicating on the internet and, you know, say, setting up their own business, who are now employing themselves. Well, nice one. You know, and that's you know, kind of, if you like, a profound level of empowerment. You know, they've suddenly become the chief executive officer of their own organization or their own, you know, business, what have you. Nice one. You know, people are able to use... The question is technology something that we as individuals are allowed to use for our own purposes, or is technology something which is the domain of multinational corporations, governments that care to surveil us closely, you know, other such sinister forces. In the end, I think we've got to take, you know, they're all taking control of this powerful technology, and we should too.
Back to the origins of Access Space. I remember I first came across you as a website, lowtech.org, which is
yes.
before 2000 when you started
Access right.
Space. So what was lowtech.org
right.
before Access Space started?
Well, originally what happened was that the story of it's actually quite bound up with the internet and bound up with kind of the sort of things that happened with the early network. I was participating in a bulletin board service that was part of something called FidoNet, which was, and get this, a do-it-yourself global communication network entirely built by volunteers. And you could use that communication network. This was in the early 90s. You could use FidoNet to communicate with bulletin board enthusiasts all over the world for free. And it wasn't part of PlusNet, British Telecom, AOL, the network was actually just over straight telephone lines using modems, and it was a sort of a communication layer on top of people's normal phone lines, which, if you like, the powers that be had absolutely no idea about. It was just quite an interesting do-it-yourself medium.
So the internet was a formalization of networking these networks in a way.
Absolutely, and also making them live. You know, at the time, we didn't have live internet communication. But to continue, I got diverted there, as always. I was working as a pretentiously called digital artist, and I was trying to make pictures, sculptures, interventions that use digital technology to process pixels and make images. I thought it was really interesting. And just to give you an example, I had an old Amiga 1200 computer, which I bought for, I think, £75, which was about my budget, and a shop security camera, which I connected to it, and I was able to get very fuzzy black and white pictures out of it. I realized that I could get color pictures out of it by using three filters, a red one, a green one, a blue one. I could take three black and white photos and combine them in software to make the three bit planes and get a color picture out of a black and white
video
source.
So although it wasn't recycled equipment, it was very low tech, and you were just making the most out of
very low tech, very low budget, if you like, available technology.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I thought, this is technology. Color pictures out of a black and white video source. How cool is that? And very excited about it. And I went to some of these kind of early digital arts congresses and symposia and things like this.
Using Silicon Graphics machines.
Absolutely. And I was so disillusioned because guys would get up on the stage and sort of say, with £30,000 worth of sponsorship from Sun Microsystems, we've rendered these multiple frames with 38 million gigaflops. And, you know, essentially what they were saying is, my disk's harder than your disk, you know. And they were not really making art. They were product demonstrating.
Yes.
And artists still need to be aware that the industry sees them as product demonstrators, and that there's all sorts of sponsorship available from the industry to show off the swanky new technology that isn't necessarily something that you need to get involved in. But, you know,
or not even without sponsorship, they get free.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And so I saw this, I was very disillusioned, and I was thinking, well, what can we do about this? We've got to get involved, you know, but, you know, am I just going to kind of join this cyber elite of people who are basically, you know, international dot show-offs? And I thought, well, I don't want to do that. I don't think it's going to be a useful thing. And it's not really going to be something that's applicable to Sheffield, except as my ticket out of here. So I'd like to get involved with something that anyone else can get involved in. Anyway, at this point, this was the point I was pulling computers out of skips. I was starting to realise that I could actually do interesting things, even with computers that I hadn't even paid £75 for. Hey, really cool. And I wrote an email to an artist, a friend of mine, basically proposing an organisation. The organisation was called Redundant Technology Initiative. And the idea of it was the digital arts organisation where we're the people that get creative with technology and do not pay. So it's a kind of a bit of a kind of refusenik attitude to the whole thing. You know, if you have to pay for this technology, we're just not interested. You know, it's like that's the kind of bottom line. This was also
how low can you go?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought that will kind of completely undercut all these kind of fancy presentations about these latest moving smooth graphics.
So it's a political ideology. You know.
Absolutely. But also a practical response. We'd basically taken a practical problem, which is me and my mates, we've got no money for computers. And we totally turned it around. What we'd done is by starting that organisation, suddenly we'd said, we don't have a finance problem anymore. What we've got is a creative problem. We have all this trash technology. How can we be creative with it? Well, hang on a second. As artists, creative problems surely is what we do. Whereas finance problems is not what we do. So, you know, it was a very simple piece of, I think at the time, it was called Ninja Economics by Heath Bunting. And he was sort of trying to suggest this idea that with these kind of martial arts like Taekwondo, you use the enemy's strength against himself. You know, if they want to push you over, you just fall over. It makes you almost impossible to injure. And, you know, that impulse to be pushing forward is suddenly something which you kind of agree with. You go along with it. And so, if you like, we used our weakness as our strength. We said, we got no money. And the point is, we're the no money people. And that was a very simple proposition. Now, unfortunately, what happened was, or perhaps fortunately, what happened was this. I sent this email to Heath Bunting saying, I've got a great idea for a digital arts organisation that doesn't pay. It's called Redundant Technology Initiative, and we'll only work with technology that costs nothing, and we'll make exhibitions. And with those exhibitions, as people see all the cool creative things that we do, they'll, of course, be inspired by it, and they'll give us their old computers so that we'll have a virtuous cycle between creativity and recycling. Every time we have an exhibition, we'll do more cool things with technology, and that will net us more.
And did it work that way?
Absolutely. But the prank, and I don't know whether you're aware of Heath Bunting as an artist, but in the early 90s, his kind of main mode of operation was the prank, right? He took that email, and without telling me, he sliced the top off, which was the bit, my introduction, where it said, hey, I've got this really good idea for an arts organisation. And he replaced it with his own introduction, which said, hey, you guys, you should hear about this really cool arts organisation in Sheffield. It's being run by a guy called James Warbank, and you know, it's called Redundant Technology Initiative. Here's what James has to say about it. And then put the rest of my email on the bottom of it. So he'd converted what was my idea into a functioning organisation. He then forwarded that email to a whole, without telling me, to a whole bunch of international digital arts mailing lists. Now, the practical upshot of that was that over the next couple of weeks, I started getting emails from all over the world, from people going, wow, what you're doing there in Sheffield sounds really cool. We'd really like to get involved. And at the time, I was sitting in my back room with about 20 computers that I'd pulled out of skips, thinking, you know, I think we've got some potential here somewhere. but there was very little else. But I just didn't have the nerve to email back to all these people and disappoint them. I was, you know, what I should have done if I was being as kind of honest as the day is long is I should have emailed back and said, yeah, well, you know, we haven't really started yet. It's just really my idea. And there's been some kind of misunderstanding. But when I got an email from Silicon Valley, from a guy in Silicon Valley, and he said, hey, we tried this in California a couple of years ago. We thought it would be a great idea to reuse all the computers that the high-tech businesses here are throwing away. You know, it's insane. He was saying they're throwing them away after 18 months. We tried to get them, and we just couldn't get it together. It just wasn't practical. And, you know, after a lot of hard work, it didn't work. He said, and I'm so happy to hear that you guys in Sheffield are making it work. And when I got that email, I couldn't. In all conscience, I couldn't email back to him and say, hey, it's just an idea. So I emailed back saying, hey, yeah, it's really good. We have all these exhibitions, and then people get inspired and they give us more stuff. And he emailed me back saying, oh, right. I didn't realize that it was so successful and up and running right now. In that case, I've got a friend who lives actually quite near to you in the UK, and he's got 60 computers, which he really needs to get rid of.
Right.
So immediately, I actually had someone then on the phone in a few days saying, yeah, these 60 computers, when can you come and collect them? And what are you going to do with them? So the kind of that prank actually created the whole organization in the first place.
And you called that low-tech.org?
Now, that was Redundant Technology Initiative, and we registered the web domain lowtech.org because we thought redundanttechnologyinitiative.com or something would be okay. Far too long.
And that's still alive.
And that's and absolutely.
And so listeners, if they want to find out more, and
absolutely,
you can go to lowtech.org.
Yeah, and in fact, now we've actually spawned off. Access Space is its own organization now.
Okay.
It's kind of formally constituted. It's a charity. It's like it's kind of raises money for itself. So that's kind of no longer just kind of my idea, if you like.
Right.
It's kind of grown bigger than that, and so it's got its own kind of independent website at access-space.org. But of course, one of the first things that the lowtech.org website does is you click straight through and you'll get to Access Space. You'll also get to the Redundant Technology Initiative site, and you'll also get to Low Tech Limited.org's computer recycling site. So that now you've immediately got choices of going to the three key things that we do. You can see some fantastic creative exhibitions and activities at Redundant Technology Initiative. You can click through to all sorts of amazing sites that people are making at Access Space. And you can also click through if you want to, if you're a company and you want to recycle your old computers, click through to Low Tech Limited, which is a company which I set up for the very purpose, so that you can get in touch with us and recycle hundreds of computers that you no doubt want to give us.
Well, I'm sure if I was listening, I'd be going there straight away. Thank you very much, James, for
this. Great stuff.
And so, having seen it myself, I'm very inspired myself as a result and getting back into Unix and Linux.
Excellent, excellent. Okay. That's what we'd like to hear.
Great. Thank you very much.